Greetings, welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a terrific show for you, talking to one of the most provocative and interesting investigative journalists working in the United States today, who's breaking a lot of the major stories that you may or may not be hearing about in the rest of our news media in the coming months and years, and that's part of what we'll be talking about today. So please join me for our show today with Greg Pallas, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
They are not well known for being backers of community media projects, but cable companies represent an important resource for activists looking for greater access to the media. Key to using your local cable system as an incubator for community media is the franchise agreement. Cable companies, by law, must negotiate franchise agreements with local governments in order to build and maintain their networks, which run through public rights of way. Sue Buskey, a consultant who works with local governments to maximize their franchise agreements, says these deals may sound complicated, but they're actually pretty straightforward.
It's essentially a very sophisticated lease agreement. Your property is being used by the cable company. Some compensation has to come back to the community for the use of that property. They are really negotiating what the rent will be for the cable company to use your property.
Local governments may collect up to 5% of a local cable system's net revenue through a franchise agreement. Many times, this money goes to finance what are called PEG channels. PEG stands for Public, Educational, and Government. These are local channels that cover city meetings, school district events, and allow public access to the cable network. But Buskey says such channels are typically underutilized unless they're supported by production infrastructure like a community media center. And smart communities will negotiate for support of such a center as part of their franchise agreements.
That means studios, multi-camera environments, editing systems, the training to use the tools of the media.
Franchise agreements typically cover 10 to 15-year terms, and the renewal process can typically take up to 3 years. Often during franchise renewals, cable companies will plead poverty in hopes of reducing its payment to a local community. But Buskey says people should be very suspicious of such claims.
Just between 2002 and 2004, if you average out what nationally, the average revenue per subscriber has gone up just about 17%. In the last 10 years, it's gone up over 105%. Between 84 and 94, it went up almost another 100%. So as you can see, the revenue that a cable company collects from having the right to use the streets and right-of-way in your community is very substantial.
Cable companies also claim that including funding in a franchise agreement for PEG channels equates to a tax on subscribers, which in turn leads to higher cable bills. But James Horwood, an attorney who specializes in franchise agreements, calls that a fallacy.
If you look at communities side by side, one having PEG obligations, the other not having PEG obligations, the total bill is not any different.
So, how can the average citizen affect the contents and quality of their local cable franchise agreement? Experienced activists recommend developing a relationship with those in local government who are responsible for cable system issues. Many communities also have citizen advisory boards, which provide public input on franchise negotiations. It's also important to pay close attention to the renewal process from beginning to end. Wally Bowen, founder of the Asheville, North Carolina-based Mountain Area Information Network, says expanding community access to cable systems requires an element of political aptitude. Speaking from experience, Bowen says activists need to choose their words carefully and not be afraid to seek out atypical alliances.
We tried the traditional approach, you know, citizen access to the media, you know, local voices, free speech and all that. Didn't get much traction. Later, 2 or 3 years later, when a county franchise came up for renewal, we switched our tactics and started talking about economic and workforce development, moving to a digital economy, young people getting training in this new media, and we got the Chamber of Commerce to back public access TV.
Unfortunately, cable and phone companies are working hard to restrict the ability of local governments to negotiate franchise agreements that include things like funding for community media centers. Most recently, phone companies, including SBC and Verizon, just launched a lobbying offensive in Washington, D.C. that would mandate a national standard for franchise agreements, and this push has tentative support from the cable industry. Such a move would most likely result in a loss of funding for public, educational, and government cable channels. That's why activists like Buskey, Horowitz, and Bowen stress the importance of mobilizing now at the local level to negotiate the most favorable franchise agreements while communities still have the power to do so. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest one of the most interesting and accomplished investigative journalists of our times, Greg Palast. You can learn about Greg Palast at gregpalast.com. He is a correspondent and a reporter whose work has appeared at BBC Television and Harper's Magazine, and he's the author of the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Greg Palast, welcome to Media Matters.
Bob, a pleasure.
You know, the last time you were here, and there's no way you would remember this, Greg. It was the show just come on the air. It was spring of 2002. And we had you scheduled as our guest, and you came to the air sort of you were out of breath, because you had just come from, I think, the Venezuelan embassy. It had been on the day that the coup attempt against Hugo Chavez's government had failed, and Chavez had returned to power after being locked in his palace for 12 hours or whatever it was.
Remember the day.
And you gave us, it was breaking news, the first time in the history of Media Matters. You gave us a breaking story on what was happening there.
Well, isn't that sad? I mean, that's kind of the story about the story itself. I mean, why does basically what was happening, just for people who don't remember that story, is that in 2002 there was the president of Venezuela was kidnapped, Hugo Chavez, a guy that our president deeply dislikes, which means that the New York Times doesn't like him either. And what happened was he was kidnapped in a failed coup attempt, but the U.S. newspapers, every single one, no exception, reported that he had resigned, recognizing his own unpopularity. This is a guy who won by landslide just before this, and in fact just recently won re-election by over a million votes. So he had resigned, and that allowed the U.S. State Department then to basically prepare to recognize the government of basically a coup d'etat, overthrowing an elected government. That's the news we got from our papers. I was working with BBC and the Guardian of London. It was the middle of the night. I got into the Venezuelan embassy and was able to reach one of the only open cell phone lines and was able to confirm that, in fact, the president had not resigned. He had been seized by guys with automatic weapons, and I had to get that out to my homeland, the USA. I was in London reporting from London. Later, I flew down to Venezuela and met with the president. But in the meantime, you couldn't bust through the disinformation. And when I have to tell you, I did ask a New York Times reporter why they reported this story that Hugo Chavez had resigned, and basically allowing then the U.S. to, and the New York Times even editorialized that goodbye and good riddance.
Mm-hmm. And, as well as the Washington
and his,
Post.
And his statement of the reporter was, well, I said, where'd you get this stuff that he resigned? Well, the State Department told us. And it was given, that response the State Department told us was given to me like, well, if the State Department told us, that's a good enough reason. The State Department's working at getting this elected president overthrown. And I can tell you that probably in a nutshell summarized the difference between U.S. reporting and European reporting, what I do out of BBC, because and believe me, the British government was also had gotten in line trying to get rid of Chavez, And if the and the British government said he resigned, and as soon as we assume it comes from an official source, we doubt it. We question it. I mean, the first thing we do is say, of course that's what they're going to say, and try to get the information. So, but the idea that, that it was a good enough excuse that the U.S. State Department said it, and by the way, it was never, ever corrected in the New York Times. The misstatement of the facts was never corrected.
You know, since the coup attempt 3 years ago in Venezuela, as you pointed out, Chavez has withstood a referendum, won a commanding referendum, in fact, to keep him in power despite the organized hostility of the business class in that community supported by the United States government. And now I think by most accounts may well be at the head of the most popular government, maybe in the history of the whole continent in terms of popular support.
In terms of right. I mean, and you know, one of the day before yesterday, the New York Times, maybe just well,
and let me point out to our listeners that just this is a good point to do this, that we're taping this show roughly 10 days before going on air on June 2nd.
Sometime in the midst of the end of May, early June, the New York Times ran an article by the guy that covers Venezuela, Juan Ferrero, and it was called A News Analysis, and basically it was a State Department teardown job on Chavez. It must have mentioned Fidel Castro four times in the article, trying to lock him into Castro, casting doubts on, you know, that he's an impediment to the sweep of democracy. Here's a guy who's elected, you know, unlike our president, by the way. And in fact, you know, and again, the problem is that you've had a drumbeat of disinformation. I mean, I don't care if our, you know, if the Times doesn't like this guy, but it's bending the news, and it's not just the Times, but most papers ignore Venezuela. But it's a good example of how the news is bent. And they use such things as diplomatic sources say. And I just, by the way, I just came back from Ecuador, where the same New York Times, State Department access of weasel information did a hatchet job on the new president of Ecuador. And, you know, I don't care if our government doesn't like it, but I'm very disappointed that our news outlets become the conduits for State Department whisper campaigns against governments that don't toe the Bush line.
We're talking to Greg Palast today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Greg Palast is the author of The Best Democracy Media Can Buy. He is an investigative journalist of considerable world renown. His work has appeared on BBC Television and in Harper's Magazine. You can go to gregpalast.com to find out about his work, see an archive of his columns and his research and his investigations. It is a pleasure to have Greg Palast on Media Matters with us today. Let me let you know, listeners, that this is a pre-recorded show done roughly 10 days before going on air, so don't call in today. Sit back, relax, enjoy the show. Let us do the yakking. Greg Palast, before we get off Latin America, this really closely relates to a lot of work you've been doing in general on the World Bank, the IMF, sort of the global trade arrangements that have been a crucial story in international politics for the past decade or so. And I think that because of the way our news media work in the United States, even Americans who, you know, are regular consumers of their evening TV news or their daily newspaper may not be familiar with what is taking place, not just in Venezuela, but across Latin America and what the changes are in the past few years. So you mentioned Ecuador. Can you talk a little bit about what Americans are missing?
Well, what's happening in Latin America is basically the entire continent is standing up on its hind legs and saying no more to the New World Globalization Order, the whole march of the so-called Washington Consensus, you know, free trade agreements, free markets, and privatization of social security systems, which, by the way, is, you know, was imposed on Latin America by the World Bank and the IMF. Basically, Latin America was turned into this experimental zone for the witch doctors of free market theories, and with the result that the continent has been economically demolished over the past couple of decades. And now the public is reacting and basically socialists and progressives or leftists or dissenters have been elected in Chile, Brazil, Venezuela, Uruguay, Peru. And now it looks like if they can't, you know, jail the opposition, that the left will take over in Mexico. And even somewhat conservative leaders, like the president of Ecuador, whom I just met with in the past month, if you're listening to this. He's a conservative guy, but he's saying no more to the diktats of the World Bank and the IMF. It's very, very important because our newspapers in America have this pro-globalization consensus. It doesn't matter whether it's the Times or USA Today, whether it's kind of liberalish or conservatish or, you know, Democratic-leaning, Republican-leaning. It's, you know, like the left-wing columnist, for example, is Thomas Friedman, who's one of the great boosters of globalization, free markets, you know, no more, you know, little government, basically kind of the Reaganite philosophy written large. And Latin America is dissenting, and we're not really getting the information about this except to get hatchet jobs on people like Hugo Chavez because he said no to the IMF. He is obviously a dictator who's in love with Fidel Castro. The president of Ecuador, the new president who just took over, I've discovered from inside the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund secret agreements signed by his government before he took over, which requires that Ecuador, which sits on a big pool of oil, turn over 90% of its new oil wealth, given the huge increase in oil prices, 90% to the bondholders of Ecuador. Now, you have to understand, Ecuador is now current on its payments. This is a windfall for the bondholders. This isn't like some money past due, payments past due. This is a windfall for the bondholders, 90%.
And who are these bondholders?
Well, that's the point, too. I mean, one of the biggest bondholders, for example, was Carlos Slim, who was the honcho who poured something like $100 million into keeping the kind of quasi-dictatorship of Mexico rolling along. He's the biggest media mogul of Latin America, close to the Bush family as well. You've got, and then you've got these, you know, unnamed owners of Ecuador's bonds who are sitting in Miami, and were, as far as the people from inside the United Nations were telling me, that these are people who had basically ripped off the nation's banks and stole the country blind and then bought up the nation's debt to maintain control of that nation at like 10 cents on the dollar, and now the U.S. is saying that they must be paid 100 cents on the dollar.
Well, Greg,
a huge windfall. I mean, it may sound technical, but in fact, what's happening here is grabbing the oil and the resources of these nations with both hands, and the people of these nations are saying no more.
Will the people of Ecuador be able to stop this turnover of the oil proceeds, or is it a done deal with this signing?
Well, it's going to be very interesting. For example, we now have Paul Wolfowitz, you know, the lion of Baghdad, who is now this month become head of the World Bank. And so the kind of conquistador mentality is now gone over to the World Bank, where it's already been quite bad. So the question is whether Ecuador will be able to stand up. It's a small country. Argentina just said, go fly.
Mm-hmm.
Just literally stopped paying its bondholders and said, stick it. Now, Ecuador is a tiny country, but on the other hand, it may also say stick it. The president really would like to work with George Bush. He was surprised when Condoleezza Rice called for quick new elections. You know, mm-hmm. he's elected, and basically it's saying Condoleezza Rice is basically saying we want this guy removed.
Mm-hmm. If I could just ask you one question that I think, Greg, is of interest, is, you know, the Chavez vision of Latin America is the Bolivar vision. That's sort of like the equivalent to Latin America, what Nkrumahism was to Africa at one time. The idea that the continent would unite and in its strength of a unified continent, it would have the power to stand up to the United States, to Europe, to other powers in the world and sort of really control its own destiny. Do you think that vision, is that having a chance now?
Well, I think it does. I mean, you know, Chavez is a very poetic. I met with him, and by the way, I even met with the guy that kidnapped him, too, by the way. That's one thing I try to do as a journalist is not get the information from the State Department, but meet with both sides of these stories and actually meet with the players and get the info. And, you know, Chavez is very dramatic and poetic in language. Lula of Brazil is used to be that way. Now he's learned how to talk like a banker. The president of Ecuador is very conservative, but they all have the same kind of vision, which is, look, we are a rich continent. We are sitting on a bunch of oil. We have resources. We have, you know, our farms can be very productive. And if we get off this kick of having, of privatizing everything where foreign owners own all our infrastructure, own all our productive processes, own our oil, we can do pretty well ourselves. We can develop our own nations. And Latin America as a unit is a tremendous economic, self-sufficient powerhouse, industrially, agriculture-wise, and resource-wise. They don't need the rest of the planet to survive. But they would like to trade with the rest of the planet on fair and equal terms. And they're just tired of being the plantation for America's elite. And I say elite, important. It's not Americans or America that they're against. I got to tell you that Hugo Chavez got along exceptionally well with Bill Clinton. He even got along very well with Senior Bush. It's just that the cowboys in the current Bush administration simply will not allow any type of dissent. And that's feeding this sense in Latin America that they've got to disconnect from subservience to the Bush elite.
Greg Palast, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. This is a pre-recorded show. Greg and I taped it roughly 10 days before going on air, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and relax. Greg, I think you first came on the radar for many Americans during the 2000 election and the immediate aftermath with your path-breaking work on the Florida scandal, the disenfranchisement of African American voters, and what happened in Florida in 2000. You have done some work since then, and recently on the 2004 election. And I don't think many of our listeners are familiar with it because this is not getting a lot of coverage outside of a pretty marginal range of our news media. What have you found out? What's your assessment of the 2004 presidential election?
Yeah, well, you got it right. For those who don't know, I broke a story for the BBC television for the Guardian papers that before the 2000 election, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush of Florida knocked off tens of thousands of black people off the voter rolls, calling them criminals, and in fact, their crime was voting while black. So we know that the election of 2002 was shoplifted in this racist manner of purging black people from the voter rolls by the tens of thousands, 93 or 4,000 people targeted. And in 2004, there was a repetition of monkeying with the voter rolls and with the votes, but done for the most part in a different manner. And I wrote a story for TomPaine.com, and again a report for BBC Television and for the Guardian papers, which was titled "Kerry Won," explaining that if you counted all the votes in Ohio, counted all the votes in New Mexico, that, in fact, and some other states, that Kerry would have won those states, giving him a majority electoral votes and giving us a different president. And the question is, why weren't those votes counted? And most people in America don't even realize that the votes weren't counted. You know, in the 2000 race, there was this long drama in which should we count, you know, counting the votes and not counting the votes and people squinting at these punch cards, et cetera. It happened in 2004, except the difference was that in 2004, number one, John Kerry conceded. You know, he threw in the towel before he even hit the mat on election night. And second, the media just said, case closed, anyone who questions the vote count is a nut. And in fact, you know, given this the media show, I think one of the more interesting things, after I wrote Kerry Won and broadcast my report on BBC, I got a call from the New York Times. You know, I seem to keep picking on the New York Times, only because they're actually one of the best. So, you know, it goes down from there. But the New York Times called me and said, we're running a story on people who believe that Bush lost the election. And I said, well, this is a matter of belief. I'm a reporter for BBC. Here's the evidence we have of the non-count of votes. And, and I wanted to tell them the evidence. He said, well, I have two questions for you. And the first question is, are you a sore loser? You know, and I said, I'm a reporter. I don't, you know, it's not my job to tell you which rich white guy should win. I'm not a sore loser. And then he said, well, question two, are you a conspiracy nut? And that was it. There was no question three.
So the evidence...
That, you know, that constituted the New York Times investigation of whether the vote was tampered with in the 2004 election. Now, if you know, that was how our media dealt with it, that, you know, are you a sore loser, are you a conspiracy nut? The next day, just so you know, the New York Times ran a front-page story that said, theories of Bush loss on Internet easily debunked. That was a New York Times story, roughly the headline. So it's Internet theories which make it spooky, not BBC television, The Guardian newspapers, Tom Paine, Internet, right, the spooky Internet.
Yeah.
And, of course, theories easily debunked. They didn't mention our BBC work at all. What they did mention was they found an amateur statistician on the net who raised some doubts about the vote count, and they, you know, had a bunch of experts demolish. This is a high school teacher, right? That was the New York Times investigation.
So they held that up as the only evidence,
right,
the main evidence that made the case.
They said that was it, and they, you know, and by the way, the interesting thing is that the University of California at Berkeley group of statisticians actually confirmed what. By much more sophisticated calculations, what this high school teacher had just run across from public documents.
And what were the statistics that they came up with?
Yeah. Here's the anomalous thing. Here's the main thing to look at. People were very, very concerned about the computer vote that you know, you'd punch in Kerry and your vote would go to Bush. And there's some questions about that. But we don't even have to look for that. There's something much simpler. In the 2004 election, between 2 and 3 million votes were simply not counted. Most of them were called spoiled votes. That is, you punched in into the machine, and it didn't register. And then in a few cases, there were something called provisional ballots, which people would make out a ballot. They were legal voters, but they may have gone to the wrong precinct, and they were told they would be counted, but then they weren't counted. Now, that's typical in a U.S. election. Typical U.S. presidential election, 2 million votes are punched into the machines, never get counted. People don't realize how crappy our voting machines are. But, you know, if it were random, you just say, well, you know, statistically it should come out about even, but it's not random. If you look at the precincts and the demographics of the precincts, I've looked at it, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission has looked at it, you have about 54% of the vote cast which is not counted for technical reasons, lost in machines, is cast by African-American voters. If you're a black person, the chance is 900% higher your vote won't count than if you're white. If you're Hispanic, your chance that your vote won't count in New Mexico, where Hispanics are almost half the population, is about 500% higher than if you're white. If you're Native American, the statistics go through the roof. I was just in New Mexico. McKinley County, which is Navajo, almost everyone there is a Navajo, and about one in seven ballots simply never registered into the machines.
You know, Greg, and I hear this, and I wonder why aren't the Democratic Party leaders, who are clearly the losers as a result of this. I mean, they work their butts off and raise tons of money to get their candidates elected. And then this takes place. Why aren't they raising hell on something like this?
Oh, that's always the big question. I mean, I you know, my joke answer is, why don't Democrats stand up? Because, you know, like jellyfish, they're invertebrates. But, you know, it's a little glib.
No, because this is a little different.
This is quite different. And in fact, actually, there's a huge split in the Democratic Party over this, just so you know. I have talked with, there are two people who are very shaken up by this. John Edwards, who did not want to concede, who had committed that all votes would be counted because he was assigned to bring in the black vote.
Mm-hmm.
And I had breakfast with him and Jesse Jackson when Jackson was saying, what are you going to do about this non-count? You have me registering a million people, and then you lose a million votes. You know, so you've gotten the idea, you've got to have registration, you've got to get out the vote. We've overcome many of the racial impediments there. Then we had the purges that you guys did nothing about in 2000. You know, we're trying to play catch-up, and now we have a non-counted vote. And by the way, if you're wondering how it happens, they're going to say, aha, that's a black person. Let's erase his vote from the machine. It's that black people get bad hospitals, they get bad schools, they get crappy police departments, they get crappy voting machines in their areas, too. You know, I mean, that there's, you know, that's It's an old story. So, you know, Edwards was very, very concerned about this and committed to Jackson to do something. Howard Dean, the new chairman of the Democratic Party, was really shaken up. But I talked to his predecessor, Terry McAuliffe, chairman of the Democratic Party, and he basically blew off the whole issue. He said, we don't have the resources, we don't have the technical ability to fight this, the Republicans have it all over us, and yet they left with, you know, $50 million in the bank on election night, the Democratic Party, $50 million in the bank, which they could have used to at least try to recover some of those votes. And that, so there's a split. But what I'm finding in places like New Mexico, where you had a, I mean, I know why it happened in Ohio. You had the chairman of the Bush reelection campaign, Ken Blackwell, was also the Secretary of State in charge of the vote, which is what happened in Florida in 2000 with Catherine Harris, head of the campaign, head of the vote count. And Blackwell deliberately and knowingly allowed old broken punch card machines to be used throughout black precincts in the state, and didn't even provide enough machines so that there are lines through, you know, for hours and hours and hours. But even if people got up to those machines, it was very, you know, their votes were simply lost to those machines. He knew it in advance, you know, that, and people don't recognize, he was actually sued by the ACLU, which said, you know, this is a violation of the United States Constitution to give people the bad voting machines.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I'll change it after the election. But in New Mexico, you'd say, well, why did it happen in New Mexico, where Bush won by 5,000 votes in New Mexico officially? Over 21,000 votes, it's a small state, only 21,000 votes, over 21,000 votes were never counted in New Mexico. Bush wins by 5,000, 21,000 votes not counted, 87% of those not counted votes came from solid Native American and Hispanic Democratic districts. It was a solid Democratic vote which is thrown out, and yet the Secretary of State and Governor are Hispanic Democrats. If so, I went to New Mexico. I said, what is going on here? And the answer is something I found also in the state of Georgia. All politics is local. It had to do with internal fights within the party. The local party elites in the Democratic Party, for example, are not always happy if there's a huge turnout of black voters or Native American voters or Hispanic voters, because their own positions then are in jeopardy. And so these internal fights, it is better, all politics is local. To the guy running for county clerk, for the people who are trying to run the state party committee, the guy who gets elected president of the United States really is of secondary importance to keeping their jobs and their privileges. Now, we can't imagine it because we love to sit around and talk about Bush and Iraq and all these things, but if you're in the trenches in politics, county clerk is a heck of a lot more important position than president, and you're going to suppress the vote that takes out your people, and it doesn't matter what party or race they are. So that, unfortunately, the splits in the Democratic Party prevent often voters of color from getting protection.
We're talking to Greg Pallas today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This is a pre-recorded show, so please don't try to call in. Sit back, relax, enjoy the show. The next couple weeks after this, we are also going to have taped shows. We're going to be bringing you highlights of the conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation, that took place in Urbana May 11th and May 12th of this year. And I think you're really going to enjoy both of these shows. We've been working on editing them. I think they're going to be terrific programs. Greg Pallas, I mean, let's stay with this story about the stolen election. I think this is a very important story, and you're doing a lot of the dirt under the fingernails work on it. Does this affect the outcome of other races besides president? I mean, would we have a different look of the U.S. Senate or the House of Representatives or state legislatures if these votes were counted?
All the way across. Like I say, a lot of the vote theft, a lot of the shenanigans have to do with manipulating local elections. By the way, the reason that all those tens of thousands of voters were knocked off the voter rolls in Florida was not to elect George Bush president. It was to elect Jeb Bush governor. That's the whole point. Jeb Bush, it turned out he had an easy race, but originally he thought it was going to be exceptionally tight. And they used the purge of the voter rolls to lock him in place. And it just happens that his brother kind of became the lucky beneficiary. when Daley stole, you know, the election 1960 for Kennedy, it had to do with Daley's need to elect a Democratic state's attorney for Cook County, the guy who's the prosecutor, the guy, and a Republican came in, he would be prosecuting Daley machine hacks for corruption. And so, you know, and it just that by playing around with that vote, you know, Kennedy became the beneficiary. In Georgia, Zell Miller, who was head of the Democratic Party, but of course infamously ended up nominating George Bush for president, suppressed the black vote in Georgia because he did not want any challenges to the supremacy of the white elite, which is running a black majority party. And I got that from members of the Democratic National Committee who were, you know, hoping to change that. But as a result of Zell Miller suppressing the vote, the Democrats lost two Senate seats and the governorship there. You know, there's no reason why Georgia should be a Republican state. If you count all the votes, like all the black votes, and you get out the black vote and you don't purge the black vote, it would be a Democratic state.
We're talking to Greg Pallas today, again, on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Greg, we're about halfway through the show, and I want to turn to another issue you've been working on, which is Iraq. In the past month or so, we've had major developments in the world, not only in the war in Iraq, but on revelations about the U.S. conduct of the war in Iraq. For starters, there was what's now called the Downing Street memo or the smoking gun memo,
yeah.
The British intelligence memo from mid-2002, which basically acknowledges that the Bush administration was dead set on going to this war long before it went to war, while it was claiming publicly it was exhausting its diplomatic opportunities, and also made it clear that it was not especially concerned with having a factual basis for its claims.
Well, in fact, if you want to read section of the memo, go to gregpalace.com.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to take credit for uncovering this extraordinary smoking gun. That was my colleagues in the British press. But I was one of the people that brought it over to the United States. I was stunned that it wasn't being reported here, which is that this is a memorandum about meetings between George Bush and Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Britain, in which Bush said almost a year before the war, Bush communicated to Blair, "We're going into Iraq no matter what, buddy, partner, and you're coming with us. And we're going to use the excuse of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism." And here's a quote from the memo. It said, "And the facts and intelligence were being fixed to this policy." I want to repeat that. The facts are being fixed. The intelligence is being fixed. This has nothing to do with failures by the CIA. You know, blaming it on the CIA is what Nixon tried to do in the Watergate break-in, blame the CIA, and didn't get away with it because our press got on him. Now, Bush used, the intelligence on Iraq was wrong. Let's have a 600-page report and blame the CIA. Nonsense. He knew the facts were being fixed to this policy, to the conclusion he wanted. This is stunning stuff. This is impeachment material. Both the fact that they were fixing the facts about war and that they were covering it up. This is you have to remember, this is why Nixon resigned. It wasn't because he ordered a burglary. Nixon never did order a burglary. He just covered it up and tried to make the CIA take, when he found out about that his guys were involved in it, he covered it up and he tried to get the CIA to take the fall. That's obstruction of justice. That's why Nixon resigned. This is the same exact thing. This is an impeachable offense, and it's obviously a very serious matter and got zero, zip, nothing coverage in the mainstream U.S. press except to say that Tony Blair was in trouble over a memo. No, this is about George, not Tony Blair's lying. It's about Blair going along with a lie by George Bush. And it's stunning that our media failed to pick it up. When I finally put it out, we were able to get U.S. congressmen, 90 of them, and the Black Caucus follows my work, obviously, because the election very closely, to sign a letter to Bush saying, explain yourself, because no media was going to do it. That got a little coverage that, you know, 90 congressmen were saying something, but the memo itself was not covered. And, of course, my team did independent investigation, found some other pretty shocking documents as well.
Yeah, well, what were some of them?
Well, and when I say my team, you know, I want to emphasize something here. investigative reporting. It's not like Greg Palast runs around like the Lone Ranger picking up cool documents. I mean, I do my share. It's an entire team, and in the case of the of some material we just got from Iraq, it's a tremendous effort. I'd like to thank Lenny von Eckert, who was the chief investigator on this one. And what Lenny and I were able to discover for BBC Television again and Harper's were two sets of documents, which were the plans for the division of Iraq's assets and oil fields and the plan for the war, plans for war, which the development of which began within 2 weeks of Bush's first inauguration. So we have one document. There were State Department meetings held in Walnut Creek, California, planning the invasion of Iraq, and included detailed plans for what to do with the oil fields of Iraq. There was and that, by the way, was under the influence and direction of the U.S. oil companies, Shell Oil, ConocoPhillips executives, etc. And the ultimate plans are drawn up by the James Baker Institute, okay, in secret.
Mm-hmm.
And we got that. We actually have the document, 323 pages long, and we talked to the people that developed the document. We mm-hmm. got them on tape. They didn't realize that they were giving us this information, but we got it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one plan. And there was another, which the neocons, Paul Wolfowitz, the new head of the World Bank, and his crew came up with, which actually was in conflict with the oil company plans. Very interesting at all this, you know, the kind of inside warring factions here, which came out a bit later, but was still, once again, developed before the invasion. A very, very detailed plan for privatizing, that is, selling off all the assets, especially the oil. In fact, especially the sales of the oil assets, it said, especially the oil, is a phrase out of that document. So, again, you know, I had the privilege of putting this information at the top of the BBC Nightly News, and in the U.S., it was barely a ripple. And you can, by the way, because, you know, our TV, you know, the CBS eyeball is now shut, as well as every other U.S. outlet, you can actually watch these Too Dangerous for America television reports at gregpalast.com. We have on real video. So you can just, it may be useful to see what it is the rest of the world knows that we don't know. And then you can understand why the rest of the world kind of has a different view than most Americans.
You know, Greg Palast, I mean, but the smoking gun memo, the Downing Street memo, the report you just talked about, what's striking about them for people who follow this closely or read the international media, isn't that they're shocking? It's just really more documentary evidence to precisely what one would expect if they studied the issue, I think you could argue.
Well, I think that it's very important. One thing I try to do in my reporting is that we often suspect, you know, like a lot of people, you know, I began my BBC show by saying, you know, a lot of people suspected that George Bush had a secret plan for Iraq's oil before we invaded. That's not true. He had two plans.
Mm-hmm.
And see, and the important thing is not to suspect that they have these things or accuse them. It's blood for oil, etc. To me, what's interesting and what's important is to actually get those physical documents in my hand, actually speak and get on tape the people that did this work and get the details, because it's very important to have the evidence as opposed to the suspicion. You don't want just the smoke. You want the gun.
Yeah,
Greg, you want the weapon.
No, absolutely. Greg Palast, one other issue I want to talk about, then I want to go to a general discussion of journalism and investigative mm-hmm. journalism in the United States. But just in the past week, Amnesty International issued its report that basically said, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't have it in front of me, that Donald Rumsfeld and President George W. Bush are war criminals. And in fact, like Augustus Pinochet, when they travel outside the United States, it would not be illegitimate for governments to arrest them for war crimes. This made it to the news because the Amnesty International is invoked favorably when they're critical of Saddam Hussein and people who are opposed by the U.S. government. And the president even paused long enough to call it an absurd report. But what's your assessment of how the journalism, U.S. journalism, has dealt with the Amnesty International report, which I think is nothing short of a bomb, and then how this fits into the general problems you've been discussing about U.S. news media?
Well, I must admit I'm less concerned with the reporting of Amnesty's views, though obviously it's very, it's certainly a piece of news that ought to be covered because they are listened to worldwide. But none of this would be shocking if we had the rest of the news on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, it's, Amnesty calls this, and it seems absurd if you haven't read these other reports. If you had, for example, if people had the information on what was going on in Guantanamo, or even worse, the prisons in Afghanistan and elsewhere that we are running directly or by proxy. Let's not forget that... in a way, the guys that were shipped to Guantanamo probably got out lucky, because literally hundreds and maybe thousands of prisoners taken during the Afghan War died as prisoners. And, that just barely covered, if covered at all.
Mm-hmm.
The secret, how would, I think Americans would have a hell of a different view of the war in Iraq if they knew about the secret plans for Iraq's oil. In fact, even some basic things. I had an interview with General Jay Garner. In other words, it's not like I'm just talking to, the Amnesties or the dissenting crew here. He was the Pasha, the main guy running Iraq for us. He was put in charge as civilian kind of viceroy over Iraq.
Was he the first one who came in immediately after the invasion?
And then he was fired because he said, look, I've been given, I showed him, and he confirmed that he was handed the second plan, a 101-page plan by Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and the neocon crew, calling for the privatization of everything in sight, for reorganizing the nation's economy, and for basically selling off their oil. And he said, if you are going to do this, you're going to need hundreds of thousands of troops to enforce it. You're going to end up with more enemies than you started with, and you're going to have to fight these people to take their oil. He said, and he wouldn't do it, and he got fired.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we had a president who runs around talking about democracy, but Jay Garner had actually called for elections within 90 days before there was this huge insurgency and ethnic split. But they didn't want that, because a truly free elected government in Iraq, as opposed to a puppet government, a truly free elected government would not have gone along with these neocon plans for selling off the oil and the assets. And so his call for elections within 90 days is one of the things that got him fired, his refusal to go along with the smash-and-grab game plan. And I think if Americans had seen this, they wouldn't be surprised when they get things like the Amnesty International reports. The Amnesty International reports just sound like, crazy lefty European fruitcakes are attacking our president again. Well, no, it's the obvious conclusion if you have the information, which, is denied us.
Greg Palastam, you are an investigative journalist. This is your stock and trade, which is, a different branch of journalism than, say, doing political journalism, although closely related. The criticism of investigative journalism oftentimes is that it's partisan journalism, that, basically it can't be trusted. And I think the New York Times, when they were querying you about the 2004 election, this is clearly what the tenor of their comments and questioning were.
Yeah, it's now considered very impolite to ask tough questions of politicians. It's just not done in America. No one's going to ask George Bush at a press conference. Like, Barbara Walters is not going to be so impolite as to ask George Bush, what about this memo that says that you were fixing the facts in the intelligence before the war in Iraq, whereas the head of the anchor of the news program that carries my reports, Newsnight, asked Tony Blair, over and over again, as did David Frost over and over again, about the memo, wouldn't let the guys, run and hide.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't let him out of a chair until he answered the question. I would ask the same question three and four times until he got an answer. It's just not done in America. And so it's seen as partisan. What I don't understand, I'm seen as like attacking poor George Bush. Well, of course, he's the guy in power. As I've said about the Democrats, I don't spend a lot of time on them because, I let sleeping dogs lie, lying dogs sleep. But when, I got to tell you, I wrote, did some pretty, I got a lot of nasty commentary about my investigations of the Clintons.
Mm-hmm.
When they were in power, it was worth looking, you know, looking into those people. And not, by the way, I didn't spend any of my time on Bill Clinton's zipper or Monica's dress. It was about, I did a lot of investigation, which you didn't see again in the United States, about energy company, dirty energy company money into the Clinton coffers.
We're talking to Greg Palast on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Greg Palast, you can is the author of the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, available in fine bookstores. You can go to his website, gregpalast.com, to find out more information about all his work. And if you become a subscriber to our weekly e-list that our producer, Andrew Boyle, sends out to anyone who signs out just once a week, we will have links for all of Greg Palast's website, his work, his book. And we do this for all our guests, so you don't have to jot this sort of stuff down. And to get a hold of, to join up to this e-list, I guess for the time being, you can email our old producer, and he'll forward it along, Victor Picard, V-P-I-C-K-A-R-D, at uiuc.edu, and Victor will send it along to Andrew Boyle. But that's the best way to do it, so you don't have to write this stuff down, because I think if you've heard today, you're going to want to follow up on a lot of the work that Greg Palast has been doing, and has done over the years for BBC TV, for Harper's, a number of other media. Again, go to gregpalast.com to learn more about this work. Greg Palast, who are the journalists you look to as doing the great work today as you look around the world?
Wow. You know, as I look around the world, you know, there's just some terrific people like John Pilger, who may be known to some Americans. Obviously, Seymour Hersh has done a terrific job in the U.S. Again, not from a U.S. newspaper. I want to, you know, say something nice about the late Ron Reidenauer, who was a great investigative journalist, who, in fact, first broke the My Lai massacre story and couldn't get any coverage. Bob Perry in the U.S., who is terrific, broke the Iran-Contra story and was basically pushed out of AP for that terrific piece of journalism. A fond remembrance for Gary Webb for breaking the CIA drug connection story. Worldwide, there's some terrific reporters, I mean, but people you probably haven't heard of, like Anthony Barnett of The Observer, that I worked with my investigative partner.
Now, The Observer is available online for folks who want to look at Barnett's work.
That's right. The Observer is a Sunday paper of The Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's terrific investigative reporting coming out of The Guardian, always has been. You know, it's encouraged. In fact, it's not that there's these great investigative reporters. I'm certainly not a great investigative reporter. What I am is I'm a guy that got lucky enough to have great investigative editors,
mm-hmm.
great investigative television producers who let me put this stuff on the air. There's 1,000 journalists out there, and many listening to this program, who, if given the opportunity and the space in their papers and the money and time and gutsy editors will let them do the work, would put out these stories. I mean, you know, I could probably name 500 guys who could do my job better than I do. It's not investigative reporters who are good. It's that I have the right within The Guardian or on BBC TV to take, or and bless Harper's Magazine for giving me a platform in America.
But generally speaking,
do it and put it out.
Generally speaking, as I understand it, though, that's not a right many journalists have in conventional U.S. news media.
Oh, they don't have it at all. In fact, there's a book, Into the Buzzsaw. I'm one of the co-writers, written by basically American writers whose careers have been crushed because they did one good story too many and would push one report too many. And obviously we have the horrendous case of the machine gunning of Dan Rather, you know, writing about Bush dodging the draft during the Vietnam War. Now,
well, how was that a machine gunning?
Well, first of all, I should say, and you know, I and other reporters, but I broke the story in '99 in The Guardian, and then broadcast it in 2003 on BBC. A year later, Rather picks it up for 60 Minutes.
And why don't you give a little background on the story, because some of our listeners might not.
Very simply, George Bush was, as it turned out, I do know that Daddy Bush, Poppy Bush, contacted the head of the Speaker of the House of Texas, who through a cutout contacted the head of the Texas National Air Guard of Texas to get George Bush in as a pilot in the Air Guard, where he could therefore safely guard Houston from Viet Cong attack, as opposed to going to the war in Vietnam. Now, because remember, he's a Yale graduate, and basically all Yale graduates, once they graduated, he was 12 days away from basically going to NAM, and was given this. By the way, he's the only guy in Air Guard history ever to be made a pilot who had never flown before. He was made a fighter pilot. It has never been done, and it was done because of the fix that was put in. I have the documentary evidence. We have the witnesses to the material, and then these records were later, some of his records of his time in the Guard were destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Rather picked up the story of the draft dodging, did a very decent job. He added one little thing, you know, that was questionable. He used a memorandum that was handed to him that he could not absolutely verify, which had nothing to do with whether George Bush dodged a draft. By the way, it was simply about whether Bush had requested the right to get out of showing up for drill. It was a minor side issue. They challenged that memo. They said it was a fabrication, which my information says it is not. They said it was a fabricated memo. Whether it was or was not, it did not mean that the story was wrong. And yet, Leslie Moonves, who is the president of CBS,
mm-hmm.
acting obviously at the direction of Viacom Corporation, which is controlled by Sumner Rosen. Sumner Redstone, who said before the election that we have to have George Bush as president. And they withdrew the story. They actually said that Dan Rather and his producer, Mary Mapes, ignored the evidence that Bush did not get ahead of others to get into the Air Guard. And yet that story is completely rock solid certain. It's so rock solid certain that I actually went to Moonves at the Sundance Festival this year and offered him $100,000 if he could provide that evidence that supposedly Dan Rather ignored. You can provide the evidence that George Bush, that the fix was not put in, because we have a pile of documents. We have the witnesses, the documents. We have affidavits in court, which were ignored by the U.S. press. It's not a hard story to uncover, by the way. I've got that evidence. If you have other evidence, show it to me, and you get $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
No takers. Where is that evidence? So when you see Dan Rather crushed by raising uncomfortable questions about our president, then any other reporter has got to read the writing on the wall and say, where does my career go if I raise my voice?
And in fact, as you know, shortly thereafter, 60 Minutes decided to postpone a story on the U.S. entry into the war in Iraq on sort of bogus evidence till after the election.
Yeah.
So as not to interfere with the election and sort of
Let's not interfere with the election by providing the information.
Yeah. They didn't want to influence the outcome.
Yeah, we don't want to influence the outcome by actually providing news. we could laugh about it, but I guess it's better to laugh than cry.
Yeah.
But that is the problem, Bob. And you know, look.
Greg, I know I hate to say this, but I hear the band tuning up, and we're at that stage of our show where they're clearing me out of the studio. I want to thank Greg Pallas. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. And I want to urge you to keep up your great work. Listeners, if you want to learn more about Greg Pallas' work, go to gregpallas.com. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And Greg, we'll get you back on the show soon, okay?
Thanks, Bob.
Right, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
My name is Ron Yates, Dean of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois. When I moved here in 1997, it didn't take me long to realize what a magnificent resource WILL is for the campus and the community. If you feel as I do that WILL is an indispensable part of our community, I hope you'll join me in supporting the station. Thank you.
Call now, 217-244-9455, to contribute to WILL, Urbana. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with occasional rain and isolated thunderstorms. The high in the lower 80s with southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, decreasing clouds with a chance of showers, the low in the upper 60s, with southeast winds around 10 miles per hour this evening, becoming light and variable. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high around 90 degrees, with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 2 p.m.